This is episode 359 of Tech Talk Radio, Australia's premier tech talk show, which aired on Monday, November the 21st, 2011.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Mr. Zuckerberg, do I have your full attention?
Why would anyone trust this government not to make a complete and utter shambolic mess of the national broadband network?
Which part of time would they like us to go back to? 1960, 1930?
Can you really give that guarantee when you don't seem to know what peak speed is? I'll tell you what it is.
Okay, great. Let's give everybody a case.
The future is here.
Like how technology has caught up with reality.
Ever since Telstra was privatised, Australians have suffered.
Technology has had a huge impact on our love lives.
On air, on the internet and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. Cast your mind back to what seems to be a lifetime ago. But just over a year ago, Google was in the news for collecting Wi-Fi information as their Street View cars roamed the planet. At the time, there was denial from Google over the collection, with the company saying it was leftover code by a developer that had found its way into collection software. Well, they're back, but this time they're telling us that they are collecting Wi-Fi details. And what's more, they're telling us how to opt out. According to Google, it's simple. All you need to do is append _nomap to the name of your Wi-Fi network. So your home network, let's call it TTR, becomes TTR_nomap. Now, this seems pretty straightforward for the tech-savvy operators, but what about the mums and dads of this world who are oblivious to the data capturing and mapping wants of the search giant? Also, it's worth mentioning that Australian privacy laws prevent companies from adding you to databases without your consent. We're an opt-in country, which means that if you want to be part of something, you have to put your hand up. Not have a company tell you, you're in by default. Only one other precedent comes to mind, which was when Telstra turned on its calling number display, which showed the recipient of a phone call the number which was calling it. But that all happened in a day before privacy was such a concern. The question needs to be asked why Google wants to collect Wi-Fi information. Apparently, the information is used for location references, for devices which don't have GPS or mobile phone connectivity, devices like iPods. According to those in the know, Wi-Fi enabled devices, including access points, but also PCs, iPhones, iPads, and Android phones, transmit a unique hardware identifier called a MAC address to anyone within a radius of a few hundred feet. Android devices collect these MAC addresses and beam them back to Google to be used in the company's geolocation database, a useful feature that allows faster location fixes for mobile phones. It's also worth noting that Apple and Microsoft operate similar databases, but do not provide an opt-out mechanism. And you thought that Big Brother was a crappy television show.
This week on Tech Talk Radio,
Adam Turner looks at ultrabooks. Susan McLean joins us in the studio to talk about developments in cyber safety. Also, Telstra to invest $100 million in video distribution. 1800 megs as a prime band for LTE or 4G worldwide. And Microsoft revises forced reboots in Windows 8. First up, though, here's Dr. Ron with this week's news roundup from the Tech Talk Radio news desk.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, iiNet sets its sights on Transact. PayPal releases a money transfer application for Facebook. Intel makes a 1 teraflop processor. The ACMA finds that online transactions are on the increase. And tech-savvy kids are making big bucks out of mobile apps. Welcome to Tech Talk News. Popular internet service provider iiNet says it's about to make an announcement about a potential acquisition, believed to be ACT-based telecommunications service provider Transact. On Friday morning last week, the ASX granted iiNet's request for an extension of a stock market trading halt pending the announcement. Industry analysts say the sale of Transact to iiNet would be a win for all parties. Transact was established in 2000 as a telecommunications and subscription TV service provider and is regarded favourably for its rollout of fibre to the premises and HFC cable deployment to a significant part of the ACT. It's believed the deal to acquire the Canberra-based telco could be worth up to $80 million. An announcement is expected in the next few days. One of the largest online payment systems, PayPal, has announced the release of a new Facebook interface to allow sending money on the world's most popular social network. PayPal says the Facebook app, called Send Money, is a simple way for Facebook users to send money between friends. No transaction fees are incurred for local transfers, but regular transfer limits and international fees still apply. The Send Money application, currently available in beta, is also linked to e-cards, which are electronic greeting cards for birthdays, anniversaries, and other celebrations. PayPal said that money could be sent easily with e-cards on Facebook. Facebook users can search for PayPal Send Money to locate and install the application in their Facebook account. International chip manufacturer Intel says it has made a processor capable of performing at 1 teraflops based on the x86 architecture used by most desktop PCs. 1 teraflops means the chip, codenamed Knight's Corner, is capable of 1 trillion floating point operations per second. By comparison, about 15 years ago, Intel announced that the first supercomputer with a 1 teraflop capacity had been newly constructed, running over 9,000 Pentium 2 chips that filled 72 cabinets. At the announcement at the SC11 Supercomputing Conference in Seattle, Intel said Knight's Corner had more than 50 cores and is intended to be used as a coprocessor for specific computational tasks. Manufacturing of Knight's Corner has only just recently commenced, and it will still be some years before consumers see the chip being generally available for home PCs. A report released by the Australian Communications and Media Authority says 62% of adults bought goods or services online in the 6 months to April 2011, up 53% from 2 years ago. Results published in the ACMA's e-commerce report are consistent with observations made by some Australian retailers. The Executive Director of Kogan Australia, Mr. David Schaefer, told the ABC that online shopping is only on the cusp of breaking out in Australia and will lead to a change in retail business models. A survey conducted by ABC News Online found that price, availability, and convenience were the main reasons shoppers now snubbed traditional retailers. The report also found that Australians are still predominantly shopping from Australian websites, but that in the 18 months to April 2011, there had been a decline in the proportion of adult online shoppers mainly purchasing from Australian websites. The full ACMA report can be found on their website, acma.gov.au. And tech-savvy teenagers are making big bucks by writing mobile apps for iPhones and Android handsets. The Sydney Morning Herald reports that one 16-year-old even claims to have turned over hundreds of thousands of dollars from his apps, while others are making plenty of extra pocket money. A 16-year-old schoolgirl recently released a smartphone app on Apple's iTunes store for just 99 cents. The application, LomoHo, is a photo editor that lets users add filters and borders before publishing to microblogging service Twitter. Apple takes a 30% commission from all sales on iTunes, but this hasn't discouraged creative kids from cutting code. Other popular releases by teenage developers include a whack-a-mole application for Justin Bieber, Earth Fortune, which displays the Earth in different colours depending on what your fortune is, and a car parking application, which reminds you where you've left your car. I'm Dr. Om, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
My experience during the course of the week, I've come to love Windows 7.
You can almost get on by confusing people already.
It's yeah, well, that's what I do best, isn't it, Graeme?
Was he not aware of that already? It surprises me that
they're not aware of it.
The internet pipe that they provide you is just a dumb pipe that you can't really do a lot of add-on service.
You really get what you pay for with those sorts of products.
And Andrew's just grimaced because he's one of those web designers that thinks that he should have control over everything about the way a website looks, and that's not the way it should work.
Graeme, you are so wrong.
So this week, we've taken the view from the couch to my kitchen table.
I agree. It makes sense.
Yes.
Why wouldn't it?
What's your favourite?
Media Player Classic.
Skyring? What's Skyring?
It's an unnatural tying together of two concepts that should be separate, Mr. Apple.
Watch out for that buyer's premium, though. That kills you if you're not careful.
Microsoft Security Essentials. It's free. It does the job.
VLC is good for people who've got no clue. No offence, Andrew, but...
None taken.
Entertaining, informative, and independent.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Tech Talk Radio for yet another night. It's getting close to the Christmas time year, which is just fantastic.
Oh, don't
counting
say
the days.
That. Don't say
out.
That. I don't want to know. Don't want to know.
Dr. Ron, what do you got for Christmas?
What have I got for Christmas?
Yeah, have you done your shopping yet and all that sort of stuff? Bought yourself presents? I've bought my presents. Haven't you bought your present? For yourself, that is.
I have actually bought a present for myself.
Yeah, I thought you had.
We'll talk about it a little bit later.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to tell everyone tonight.
It's all
not going to do a Graeme on us.
No, I'm not going to do a Graeme on you.
Hang on, what did I do?
Well, you'll find out.
How did I get in trouble already? I haven't even said anything.
Hey, there was a funny promo. There's a lot of anger in the studio tonight. Last week, sorry.
Oh, it was good. And it extended to the car park afterwards, which was even better, wasn't it?
Bit of fisty cuffs, but nah, it was good. It was all good.
Yeah, anyway.
It'd be boring if we all agreed with each other.
Wouldn't it? The only person we haven't heard from is Lena Van Deventer.
She sits on the squeaky chair.
Squeak, squeak.
She is. And she's attended this evening, which is just fantastic.
I had a very good reason to not be here last week.
I know, we know.
How was it? Very, very lucky to be able to tell everybody
where you were.
I was at GCAP, which is the Game Connect Asia Pacific Conference.
I told you it was GC something.
It was. GCAP.
What did you do there?
I learnt all about the industry side of games making and games development. And it was very, very fascinating. I learnt spoke to some very, very interesting people and was very lucky to be given the opportunity to go because I wouldn't have been able to afford it if I'd not been given that lovely opportunity. So it was fantastic. Something I've never done before. Something I'm looking forward to doing again.
Did you rub shoulders with the rich and famous?
I did.
With the hoi polloi?
I did. Yeah. I actually took Mike Acton from Insomniac Games from the States. I took him to the Manabar and beat him at Rascals. So that felt pretty good. Yeah. There's a lot of little good things like that happening.
Excellent. Well, we missed you last week.
Oh, thank
Everyone in the chat room said, where's Lena? We want to talk to you about Steam. What happened with Steam?
It kind of went, bleh.
It did.
It got hacked. There's not a lot of information out there on what's actually been hacked, what portion of it has been hacked, but it seems like it's not too bad.
Not too bad?
At the moment.
Not to a Sony level?
No, nowhere near a Sony level, no.
So what should people do if they use Steam to get their games?
Change your password was probably the best thing to start with, and just keep an eye on everything and have a look over what's been happening over the last
delete your credit card
few
details
weeks
or something.
Well, it's too late. They've already got the database that had the encrypted credit card details in it.
Okay.
So if that's what they're after, they can continue to work on brute forcing that encryption to decrypt it. And at some point in the future, they may break it in the future and no one will know, of course.
Of course.
Mm.
So this is an example of a online vendor doing the wrong thing by storing our credit card details instead of asking for them every time, and thus exposing us to this risk.
Mm.
Thanks, Steam.
Mm.
Good on you, Steam.
Mm.
Okay. Think about that when you're buying stuff online. If the site remembers your credit card details from one visit to the next, then that's a security risk that you need to be aware of.
Oh, yeah.
And you might be better trusting a site that asks for it separately every time.
Very good. All right. We had lots of correspondence come in during the course of the week. Dr. Ron, I saw plenty come in the door for everybody. Fan mail galore.
I had a favourite.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
You better be reading that one out.
I'm reading your one out. Don't worry. It's the Punch and Lena show by the looks of the correspondence. got some fans out there. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au.
And the chat.
And the chat. Yeah, come and chat to us if you're listening
there
live
tonight.
In the chat room. Hello to all of our regular listeners as well in Bendigo on Phoenix FM. It's great to have you on board Wednesday nights.
Yes.
And YFM in Launceston on Saturday afternoons.
Yes.
Welcome aboard. Hope you're enjoying Launceston.
Launceston.
And while we're sending cheerios, everyone else who listens to us on Friday morning.
Yeah, but you say beta. I say beta. Sorry, Andrew.
Oh, absolutely.
Hi, everyone, Friday morning. Who listens on Friday morning?
I know. You do.
Do I?
You were driving through the country and you were tuning in on Friday morning. Then you got a phone call or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When you're down the country. On the CBAA network.
Oh, okay. No, they weren't running us on the Friday morning.
Oh, weren't they?
No.
Oh.
So edit that out of the podcast.
So hang on, just to clarify, you were listening to the show at a time when it wasn't actually on.
No, I wasn't listening to the show at all.
Oh, okay. Magic.
Now we're very confused.
Magic.
If you're confused like us, chat.techtalkradio.com.au. Andy B's just joined us. There's number one for the evening. But off you go with the coro there, Dr. Ron.
Hi, Andy B. That's two.
That's two.
Mark P via direct email to the panel says, hi, team. Mark's too good for the contact form. Did you notice that? He just emailed us directly.
Ooh.
Does he know our email addresses, does he?
He does. Oh. But you can do that.
Who is this?
Mark. Mark P.
Mark P.
So he's bypassed triage.
He's gone straight to the ward.
Wow.
Triage.
He's bypassed Andrew's spam filter. That's what he's done.
Mark, let us know how you manage that. He says, hi, team. I've heard a lot of discussion about how Android lacks a Siri. But to achieve tasks like send text messages, play music, make appointments, navigate places, etc., these voice actions have been in Android for a few years. Maybe people aren't aware that when you open that native Google Voice search app, it does a whole lot more than just voice web search. I don't know what the purpose of Iris for Android is. when this functionality is already baked into the operating system? Am I missing something? No, you're not missing anything, Mark. I think we all were missing something. I put the Google Voice search through its paces, and yeah, it does. You can just tell it to call people in your contacts, and it does a lot more than just Google Voice search. Mark's right. I have a Galaxy S and a Galaxy S2. Both have taken this to the next step and offer complete hands-free operation, which has been great for when driving. You double-tap the home screen, says Mark, and it goes into driving listening mode. So if you need to use a voice action, you say, "Hi, Galaxy." A bit cheesy, I know, he says, and it wakes up to take your request. Oh, and Graham, keep up the smart comments, retorts. Ooh. Love it.
Okay, is that a...
That was a bleep.
I'm not sure whether I should be happy about that or not.
I think you should be happy about that. Mark has also put a link there to a little YouTube video, which explains... It was actually uploaded to YouTube in August last year, and it explains how the Google Voice Search app works on your Android phone. So thanks for the feedback, Mark. That's good to know.
That's good.
Have you used that on your Android?
I like Vlingo, but you guys don't.
Oh,
mine works.
It's unusable by the sound. How can you
well, only
it?
By these two. I don't know what they do.
That's still 2 out of 3.
I know. So I could demonstrate it in the studio for you, but they won't believe me.
We'll do that in the break.
Okay.
All right. Angus via the Tech Talk contact form says, "Hi, guys." Hi, Angus.
Hi, Angus.
This gripe up, is directed at Graham.
Oh, here we go again.
At the end of the show last week, you talked about the very good Log Me In service. However, Graham mentioned that he had a better solution, and it's been bugging me all week what it might be. I'm the resident IT expert for family and friends, and although Log Me In is very good, I'd love to hear any better options. Come on, Graham, don't leave us hanging.
Now, I'm very curious here. I want to go back to the tape.
Tape?
One of us should have a tape.
Back to the flash drive.
The flash drive.
What's a tape?
Because I want to find out whether I did say that my solution was better. I think I just said I had a different solution. I don't think I said it was better. But, I just said
well,
it was different.
The listeners are emailing.
Yeah.
You must have said, what's the word in that email?
You must have said that you had a better solution.
There we go.
And it's been bugging me all week. Don't leave us hanging. Love the show. Keep up the good work.
Better.
Better. Well, I don't know whether it's better.
Don't know whether it's better? Really reserve judgment on that one?
Yeah, because I haven't really played with Log Me In properly, and people do seem to like it, and including colleagues of mine, so... I've got no issues with Log Me In. It's just that my solution happens to be a different one.
Okay.
What I've done is I've created a little application that uses the VNC protocol, which is the free remote desktop protocol.
VNC?
VNC.
Virtual Network Console, is it what it stands
for? Virtual Network Computing, or
Computing,
something, yeah,
something
VNC.
Like that.
Anyway, it uses the... Yeah, that's a different thing entirely. Now you're confusing people. Stop it. I use the... There's a flavour... Please, can I get to the end of what I'm trying to say and stop playing silly sounds?
Sorry.
It's
my phone.
I use a flavor of it called Ultra VNC, and you can build a standalone application that just an .exe file, doesn't need any other files with it, doesn't need to install onto a system. You can give that .exe file to somebody, they can double-click it, and then their system makes a connection back to my system over the internet, so it's completely safe because I'm not making a connection into the target machine. The target machine's making the connection back to me.
And so it's Ultra VNC, is that what it's called?
It's called Ultra VNC, and it's...
You're reading the chat?
No.
They're getting stuck into you in the chat.
Oh, yeah, I'll read it later. Yeah, so the Ultra VNC, there's a name for it. It's the standalone sort of help desk client mode, and you can create your own customized .exe with your own IP addresses and links or whatever, and just distribute that to people and have them connect into your machine.
Very good.
So that's what I do.
Very good.
And I leave the .exe behind on customers' desktops and on their shared drives, on their networks and things like that.
And they
like
don't mind? Obviously, you tell them what it is.
I tell them what it is and what it's for, and that's what it's there for. It's there to help them. And if they don't double-click on it, it doesn't run and there's no connection made. And the worst thing that it can do is make a connection to one of my two IP addresses. So... It's not particularly dangerous.
So it's a bit more secure.
No one can connect into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the security is like on Log Me In. I presume it's pretty good.
Well,
Log
Me In is basically a web-based device. You have to download a little app, like you were sort of saying, but it basically means that through intervention by both ends of the conversation, for want of a better way of describing it, then you can then share a desktop. Or if it's one of your trusted desktop-y things, you can just connect in from home. We have a guest in the studio, James. He's waving his hand.
Great for radio.
It's great for radio, James. Just grab a mic.
I use a lot of these tools all the time, and I use a lot of VNC as well, and I actually use LogMeIn too, and there's also something called TeamViewer, and there's a few other tools.
Oh, now you get them going.
And to answer the question of which is better and why, VNC is really good because it's completely free. Right, but VNC's implementation of how it actually grabs the screen is very poor. So the efficiency of the updates on the screen is very bad. It's the worst out of all of the tools out there. So if you're using something like TeamViewer or LogMeIn, they've got much lower level code that picks up the screen faster and more efficiently. So it's updated faster. It's easy to use. You get much better feedback. And so a lot of people are using the paid versions because they are more efficient and better to use. But if you're doing your own support for your own reasons, VNC does a good enough job for most people. And on that topic, if you're really into the open source, there's a product called EchoVNC, which allows you to build your own LogMeIn type server that uses your own VNC implementation, so you can run your whole LogMeIn type service by yourself. So that's a pretty cool tool if you're into that.
Very good. That was the voice of our guest coming up very shortly. Susan McLean's just walked in the door too. That's all happening here tonight. That was James Gardner. We'll be chatting all sorts of things about cameras and things like that very shortly.
And so. Yes, James is absolutely right that the efficiency of it is not 100% great, but it's just a nice, simple, quick solution that it works. In general, the limited performance is not a huge issue to just do a few clicks and changes. If it's anything more than that, you can use one of the other solutions.
Well, there you go. I never knew desktop monitoring would be such an issue, but there you go. And someone, Primal, in the chat said 256-bit SSL as well. I think if I'm reading between lines, tell GC, since he's not reading the chat till later.
There you go. That's, yes, and what he's alluding to there is that some of the other services have much much better security. That there would be with 256-bit SSL on something like LogMeIn, there'd be no chance of anyone intercepting the data in between the two clients, whereas with VNC, there is a possibility that someone could intercept the data in between the clients. But how much of a problem that is depends on what you're doing. If you're not sending passwords over the link, or if you're not sending, you know, confidential data, it's probably not a huge risk. But yeah, horses for courses. There's reasons why there's lots of different ones.
And last but certainly not least, Power Mac GeForce says, "Hi Lena and the rest of the team." So it's Lena's show now, is it?
Adam was Lena's saying she was. There was a conspiracy theory the other week, wasn't she? But anyway, that's another story.
The Lena Show with Tech Talk Radio.
Yeah,
love the show. I just wanted to let Lena know that I too love my Apple products and have since 2002.
Attaboy.
I don't like it when the boys hassle you about it. They are a quality computer.
That's right.
Adam Turner's view from the couch last week only confirmed the hassle of owning a PC, which is to run the gauntlet of tweaking it, removing bloatware, and looking to optimize its processing speed.
Exactly.
Like most Mac users, we just turn the power button on and it's tweaked. To my tally, I've converted 4 work colleagues and 3 siblings to Mac format. Only problem is they all love the no-hassle work environment of their new Macs. Too bad you can't get that same result out of the box with a PC. Go, Lena.
Why, thank you.
Keep up the terrific podcast from Power Mac GeForce.
So Power Mac GeForce is an interesting acronym.
This year.
Do you know him?
No.
Oh, really?
I don't know. My dad. Not even a little bit.
Oh, really?
No.
Excellent.
Completely unsolicited. If you'd like to contribute to Lena's technology radio program.
Correct. This is how to do it.
feedback@techtalkradio.com.au.
All right. Now, coming up after the break, Susan McLean, cyber safety expert, joins us. She's no stranger to this program, and we'll find out all the latest trends and goings on that we might have cause for concern about.
Listening to Australia's most informative technology show,
Tech Talk Radio.
I'm surprised they don't stand out the front healing lepers.
Trying to model these proteins takes a huge amount of computing power.
Looks like something Lady Gaga would wear.
I think a lot of people did give them shtick.
The boot up time is actually faster than the mobile phone 7 time.
Circuit switch networks, packet switch networks, 2 different things.
How do you kill it?
Put it in the washing machine.
Then Graham replied,
yes,
doesn't like the way it looks in jeans.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show,
Tech Talk. Talk Radio.
That you are. And joining us on the panel this evening is cybersafety guru expert. She knows everything there needs to know. Already taught us a few things, and she's only been here 5 minutes. Susan McLean, welcome back to the radio station.
Good evening. Thanks for having me back.
Ah, that is a pleasure. So you're no stranger to coming in and having a chat to us. You've led us down many paths of how to look after our kids online before and what to be wary of and all that sort of stuff. And I thought it was timely. Coming into Christmas, kids will be getting all sorts of new little toys, from iPods to iGadgets to computers to laptops. Even mine got one the other day. And parents are probably, needing to know what to do, what to look out for, all those great tips that you have. So what's the latest and greatest in respect to what we should be looking out for as parents? I've got two young ones. What should I be looking out for, Susan?
Oh, I think what you've got to do is be involved. I think that's the main thing. And the other one, of course, is if you're going out to buy them a whiz-bang piece of equipment, and mm-hmm. I was in the Apple store yesterday on the weekend, and you could not get in the store. So, I guarantee that Santa's going to be delivering a lot of those I-type gadgets. Mm-hmm. Know what they are, know what they do. I mean, mm-hmm. I routinely have people say, my child has racked up a $5,000 bill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, whose fault's that?
Yeah.
It's not the child.
Yeah.
It's the fact that, A, you've used it as a babysitter and you haven't really taken any interest in what your child has been doing on it. You haven't disabled all the bits and pieces. So if you're going to give them something, not a problem, but make sure you know the ins and outs of it as well.
Good advice. So last time I think we spoke, I think sexting was all the rage in respect to things that were out there, but obviously that was so yesterday.
It's still today. Yeah, today and yesterday. Probably tomorrow too.
What is today?
Well, what's sexting, first of all?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a good question, Dr. Ron.
Sexting is, look, it's been around as long as mobile phones have had cameras on them. And really it was a term, and I think it's in the Oxford Dictionary now. It's one of the ones that were added recently to describe a series of sexy texts or sexually explicit images sent essentially via a mobile phone to mobile phone. But what we're finding now is the term is used to talk about any sort of sexually explicit or naked image that's shared over the internet. So mobile phone, on a social networking site, through a video or photo uploading page or something like that.
Mm. So I thought Shane Warne and Liz Hurley were the only ones that did that, but it's a bit more widespread.
Look, it is, and if you're an adult and that's your cup of tea, I probably usually say go for it, because the only law that you've got to worry about is Murphy's Law, and that's the one that says one of the two of you are going to lose your phone on that particular given day when you've got the those special images on it. But the problem, of course, is when it involves children under the age of 18.
Yeah.
And not only are there fairly significant social and emotional consequences, there's also very, very serious criminal ones, and that's a big thing at the moment.
Mm-hmm. What happens, I guess, obviously underage is one thing, but what happens when it's underage sending to underage? Is the parent responsible for all that?
No, unfortunately, it's the child. The law doesn't differentiate. It's like any law that we've got. There's not one law for kids and one law for adults. There is the law.
Yeah.
And everyone over the age of eight is expected to know, obey and understand the law. When it involves two children, let's say two 15-year-olds or two 16-year-olds, it doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
Still treated exactly the same. So, for example, you've got a 16-year-old girl. She takes a sexually explicit picture of herself to send it to her boyfriend because she loves him dearly and he's promised not to send it on to anyone else until at least tomorrow, but he forgets to add that bit. So she sends it.
Yep.
That essentially can be manufactured child pornography. That's a charge against her.
Yep.
Transmit child pornography against her as well.
So she could be charged with a criminal offence for taking a photograph of herself.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And then he gets charged with possession because he's in possession of it. And there is no exclusion. So there is no, oh, but I knew the girl, or oh, but we're in a relationship, or I had permission, or she sent me one first, or, there's nothing. The law is very, very clear. And whether it's right or wrong, that is a debate, and I think the Victorian government has launched a review into it. But at the moment, this is what we've got to deal with, and kids need to understand it.
So it's 8 years old and above. Everyone's applicable to the same laws. I guess that's good for parents to know too. So what would happen down the track if, say, a young person entered into some activities like that and they got caught out? What would be the ramifications? Would the parents get a knock on the door, or would the school get involved? What would happen?
Well, it depends how it sort of come to light to the police. More often than not, schools become aware of it. The gossip's around the school, or it's found on the school server because it's on the computer and the computer goes into the help desk. It's found on a phone. And schools are obligated to notify the police when there's child pornography. I mean, it's sort of like marijuana and it's weapons. It's not those sort of things that you can, you know, keep in the drawer anymore and deal with at the end
of
the year.
So it's mandatory. The school must inform the authorities about what they've
found. Especially, yeah, with child pornography, absolutely. And so you've got the police involved there. So therefore the police would, in fact, probably knock on the door to the parents and make an appointment to have a chat to the young person. But routinely we're seeing young people that have consensually sent these images to each other being charged with these very, very serious offences. And not a week goes by that I don't get someone ring me and tell me about it somewhere in Australia.
And I guess also you'd probably find that most young people know that they shouldn't do it anyway. Do you find that?
No, I don't think they do. I think they often get caught up in the moment. Yeah. It's a fit of passion. It's technology. And they seem to think if they say it's okay, it is okay. It's really, really interesting because I talked to them about the fact that, well, what if I decided to drive home from this talk and run every red light? Because guess what? Red means green today and I reckon it's okay. And they laugh and they know that that can't happen. But when it involves technology, when it involves them, there's almost this disconnect in the brain waves. And they honestly, a lot of them firmly believe that if they say it's okay, then it is.
Interesting mindset that they have, isn't it? So, all right, we're talking to Susan McLean. Cybersafetysolutions.com.au is the website where people can see what you've been up to and what you're doing and all those sorts of things. Some great videos up there of recent television stuff too, which has been great. What trends are we seeing now, Susan? Obviously, there's new technology, new sites, new things coming out. What are the kids up to these days?
If we look at a bit of a snapshot of the year, probably in the first third of the year, we had problems with gossip pages on Facebook. So
Facebook's still a maiden culprit, is it?
Look, I don't want to demonise Facebook because I think it has merit and I think it is useful. And you know what? It's not Facebook's fault that someone gets on, chooses to misuse it. Mm. That is not their fault at all. They've got terms and conditions of use. They have rules like the road rules. If you choose to speed, you choose to speed. We're never going to stop everyone from speeding. So, you know, a lot of people say, oh, Facebook should do more. But really, what more can they do? Because they make it very clear how they work. They make it very clear about the fact they work on self-reporting. And they have rules about how you should conduct yourself and what sort of things you should post and all of that. And if people choose to disobey that, there's going to be a problem. But we had gossip pages at the start of the year. Example, there was one called East Donny Goss. Of course, that was centred around East Doncaster and everyone joins in and writes.
Yeah, suburb of Melbourne, yeah.
Yeah, so
this is a Facebook group.
Yeah, Facebook group within Facebook. And they started off to be quite, there'd be something like central goss, non-descriptive. So you had to sort of work out central to where.
Yeah.
Then you got the big city goss. And then it sort of drilled down. So you got, like, there was East Donny goss, Templestowe goss, Ivanhoe goss. Like, so it became suburb-specific. And then it even moved down further into some schools.
So they're
pretty vile and vulgar sites. The people that set them up, you know, claim administrative rights and, you know, all care, no responsibility. And then just allowed people to post the really vile, vulgar comments. So that was about the first third of the year we were dealing with a lot of those.
Yep. Has that disappeared now or is that?
Still there a little bit, but not as problematic as it was. Then we moved on to within Facebook again, similar sites to gossip pages, except they were called root rater pages. So these rated people's sexual performance.
Oh, good.
Truthful or otherwise.
Yeah.
And you could probably go down the path of otherwise.
I would have thought. But Photoshop's always been a wonderful thing of putting wrong. You know, you can certainly doctor images and put certain people's parts of body. Yeah. But I could imagine that would be a big issue. But, yes, same thing with those sort of sites.
Is Facebook responsive, Susan, if these sorts of sites are reported?
Absolutely.
If somebody finds them offensive, they'll pull them down, no questions asked?
Yeah. Look, I mean, they have to review them.
Of course.
And what they've got to do is then make sure that they breach their terms and conditions of use, which these sites clearly do. A lot of people complain, oh, I reported to Facebook and they did nothing or they didn't tell me what they did. They don't tell you what they do. That you send your report in, you get a little thank you for the report, and then they do act. They're obligated to act and they want to act. You know, in my dealings with Facebook, and I routinely go up to Sydney and have a chat to the girl they've installed up there as sort of the head of Australia and Asia of Facebook, who she's absolutely fabulous. Mm-hmm. They don't want the rubbish on Facebook.
Well, it's not in their interest, is it?
No, it's not in their interest, but the way it's set up, it is set up for self-reporting. So you go on it, you find something that's inappropriate, you tell them about it, they deal with it. And they are quick to action. Of course, police all around the world have access to a dedicated email address where they can get offensive content pulled down very, very quickly.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, so that's a useful feature for them. So it's not like they actually have to go through the same processes as citizens, but certainly Facebook are very responsive to that.
On.
Well, these sites that you mentioned before, like the Doncaster one, for example, do you know if there's been any police action taken against the originators of those sites?
Yeah, in relation to the administrators of the sites, up until recently...
Like groups, I should say. Sorry,
yeah, no, there wasn't. But what we saw is, I think it was almost an Australian first, and it was about a month ago, Bendigo police charged two men in Bendigo or in that vicinity somewhere with being the administrators of the site. So up until then, the police had sometimes charged the person that posted, so that was one of the criminal offences.
Yep.
But they have now charged two people with being the administrator because that was to allow to publish the obscene and offensive content. So that's a great step forward.
Who... You were talking before about the Facebook being responsive to complaints about offensive content or objectionable content, whatever. Who decides what's objectionable and what's, you know, what's okay and what's not? Where does that line get drawn and who draws it?
Well, I suppose in relation to content on Facebook, it would be Facebook themselves. If we're talking about objectionable content by law, that would be a decision that a police officer would make in relation to a criminal proceeding. But when you're going to report content to Facebook, they would be looking at it as per their terms and conditions of use. But I'm pretty sure when you
actually... So that's going to vary from site to site. So Facebook will have their rules and some other site might have different rules.
Yeah, so if you were looking at, let's say, PornTube or something, I'm sure their rules would be slightly different to Facebook about what was objectionable content.
But even two different people looking at Facebook might have different ideas of what's objectionable.
They could, but I think when you look into the definitions that Facebook use, they're fairly clear about nudity, they're clear about violence. Like they've got a whole raft of like things that they tick the box with. So it's a little bit hard for people to interpret them differently. It's fairly straight up and down.
Fair enough. Okay.
I also remember too, I was at a Google talk once upon a time. They have software which actually detects or looks at images and they can determine the amount of flesh as opposed to the amount of back, all those sorts of whiz-bang.
Yeah, the pink pixelation gets picked up in
like
Facebook.
Ratios of, of colours and things.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm sure there's obviously not only is it human intervention in these sites, there's also electronic intervention
with,
as well.
With the words, it tends to be reporting, like someone sees it and reports. With the pictures, yes, they have that little trigger for lots and lots of pink pixelations, which would normally indicate a naked body, and then they will look at it.
Susan, do you find much, like we have a digital divide, the haves and have-nots in certain areas of regional Australia and the city. Do you notice that any, you mentioned Bendigo earlier on in your course of the discussion, is it just as prolific in regional parts of Australia as it is, that cyber bullying and,
absolutely.
And all this sort of stuff.
And
there's
it's often
no one
worse.
Specific area.
No.
Worse in regional?
Not. Well, yes and no. It can be worse. The impact can be worse because if
smaller communities.
Smaller community. Everyone knows each other. So if you are named and shamed on one of these pages, everyone's going to know. If you find your way onto one of those pages in Melbourne, you know, it's less likely that someone that actually knows you is going to see it. So the impact is far worse. There's certainly risk in rural communities. And you talk about the haves and have-nots. I think when it comes to technology, that divide isn't really as great as people believe. Even if we look to charitable organisations, we look to foster care, we look to that. Whilst a lot of organisations don't dish out dishwashers, washing machines and clothes dryers to families in need, there are hundreds of organisations that will dish out computers because they...
Well, they're so cheap these days,
they are cheap, but they also understand that it's important for a child's education. So you'll get into a house that might have nothing else, but they will have an internet connection, they will have a computer. And, of course, the Rudd government was famous for promising a laptop to every student. So, you know, the accessibility of technology really... It's rare that a child cannot access it when and where they want. It might be a little bit the connection's dodgy or something like that blows in and out. But reality is that they are connected in greater numbers than ever before. And often country kids are more at risk.
Are there more support networks available out in the city than there are in the country?
Absolutely in the city. Yeah. I spoke last week in Ballarat at the Australasian Rural and Remote Mental Health Conference. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've got quite serious issues in mental health in rural areas. And they lack the support networks that we have in Melbourne or in a capital city. So anything to do with health, well-being and welfare is always more difficult to deal with in a smaller community. The infrastructure's not there, the support networks are not there, there isn't a neighbouring school to call on or, you know, a neighbouring this or a neighbouring that because the next neighbour is 100 kilometres up the road.
Mm. So interesting times, I guess, too, with the technology that we've got the National Broadband Network rolling out, which is making everyone more connected than ever before.
Internet's just becoming more and more accessible than it's ever been.
And faster. Yeah. So, yeah, the remoteness of a lot of people, I guess, would play a major factor in what they can do, like taunting from afar. They probably think, oh, well, you're not going to get caught or you're minimising your risk because you're so far away. But that's furthest from the truth now. It's such a global village. And we're also seeing the regional issues coming along board as well. I was quite surprised you mentioned, you know, rural Victoria before. I thought, oh, it's you sort of think that it's a real community feeling and a real community environment, but it only exacerbates the problem when that sort of thing happens.
And this year I've spent a lot of time in the Wimmera and Mallee. I think I've had 4 full weeks out of the year.
Because you go around and you talk to kids talk to groups,
you know,
don't you?
Kids and teachers and parents and a range of other professional organisations. I work with the AFL, Netball Victoria. I've done talks to law firms, to corporations, the MFB, peer support officers I spoke to a couple of weeks ago. But what I'm seeing, especially in the rural and remote areas, is there is a need. And I've gone into, you know, small country towns. I've been to Goroke, Edenhope, Dimboola, Birchip. You know, we're talking not big regional cities. And they've got terrible issues. And, yes, you think that, you know, kind community spirit is there. And by and large, it is. But they're not immune from the problems, and they're also not immune, their kids are not immune from online grooming and sexual solicitation because they're so vulnerable. They are nice, trusting country kids that don't necessarily have the street smarts of a Melbourne teenager.
Mm. Are we seeing any trends develop out in the country which we're not seeing in the city, or is it all just right across the board?
No, I think it's really right across the board. It doesn't change much between ethnic groups. It doesn't change much really between socioeconomic groups, and it doesn't really change much between male versus female. So we're fairly consistent. I think Australia has the biggest uptake of technology use of any Western country. You know, we really love our technology. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, our education programs are not keeping pace.
Since you last saw us, which is probably about 12 months ago, are you probably more busier now than you have ever been? So obviously the reason I ask this is you're obviously the problems are getting bigger or there's more of it or...
There's more of it, which really I suppose is twofold. There is more of it and there are more people connected, so therefore there is more of it. So there's, you know, two prongs to that. Yep. More people are aware of it. They want to act. They want to do something about it. Don't want to get caught out anymore.
And how are you finding those people who do want to do something about it? Do they know what to do?
No.
So I think last time you were on the show, you gave us some great tips about what to look out for from a parent's point of view to keep an eye on kids. And I think we had a really good success. I think we got an email back from a listener saying that thanks to what you said, they could highlight issues. They took the young person aside and had a chat and found that there was an issue. What should parents do? And I guess we go to a lot of rural centres now too, our particular show. So what are you on the lookout for? Like used to be mobile phones under the bed covers and lack of sleep. Any other telltale signs?
I suppose the best advice I can give parents is to become the world's best expert on their own child and notice any subtle changes. Cyberbullying or the incidence of cyberbullying can, I suppose, be displayed in many ways. It might be that your child's got the latest virus going around, but, you know, they may in fact be being cyberbullied. So usually you see a change in friendship group. What I call nondescript illnesses, you know, the tummy upset, the headache that just happens to come on every day when you're about to go to school. Lack of application to your studies or to sport. You know, second only to schools for cyberbullying now is sport.
Sport bullying?
Cyberbullying within sport.
Really?
I've done a lot of work in sporting clubs.
Hence the netball things you were doing before.
Yeah, so the VCFL, the Victorian Country Football League, were the first sporting code, honestly, the second sporting code I worked with to develop a cyber safety policy. Netball Victoria is another one.
We digress. What about the AFL? They're always in the news for the wrong reasons, aren't they? What we alluded to earlier on in the show.
They are, but I think the work that I do with AFL clubs is a little bit different. That's about the players learning how to protect themselves. Like, very few of the players go online and write a tirade abuse about an opposition player. You know, that they just know that they're going to get into trouble if they do that. But what we're seeing in other sports, so one step down or even several steps down from elite level, is people knowing that they can't, I suppose, vent on the field anymore. We've really jumped on what you can say on the field and how it shouldn't be disrespectful and all of that. But that's now tend to be carried on online. So we see threats, we see vile and racist comments, and it flows through into the game. So someone gets belted behind play because of what happened on Facebook. And the leagues, and this is common, and the clubs and that are floundering to deal with it because they don't have policy in place. So that's what they're coming to the realisation that they need to have a concise policy document.
All right, so back to telltale signs for parents, because you were talking about not wanting to go to sport. Now you've explained why there might be sporting relation issues.
Yep.
But what should the parents do? Should they confront the young child or the young person?
Talk to them,
involved?
Absolutely. Try and raise the subject.
Yeah.
I always say a good place to have these conversations with children is in the car if you're driving them somewhere, because they're captive, they can't escape, and they don't have to look at you.
Drive
because
faster.
they're sitting beside you. So you can have that sort of, they might be in the back, so you can have that sort of non-threatening conversation, but bring it up and talk to them and let them know that regardless of what's going on, you will support them and they can come to you.
And if there's a coach of the local under-16s that happens to be listening as well, Susan, and they're very much aware of this sort of a thing going on within a club, but they don't know what to do. You know, is it the same sort of approach, I guess?
Yeah, and I think, the clubs have a major role to play because they are representative of the community, and we've got the problems in the community. We're going to see them everywhere. But become involved, make inquiries. You will have, even if you don't have a defined cyber safety policy, you will have a member protection policy, you will have a code of conduct, there will be something you can link it back to. Get the parents involved, let them know, because unfortunately what we've seen in the past is young people commit suicide as a result of cyberbullying, and we really don't want that to continue.
There's got to be a lot of mental health issues too, I would imagine, too, in respect to fear of going to school, fear of going to play sport, fear of going out. Obviously, that's a telltale sign for parents too, unless, you know, you've got to cotton on, why don't you want to do this? Are those the questions?
And to look at also their internet or their technology use, so a distinct change in their technology use, so something like being online all the time when they weren't really fussed, or not being online at all when they were always online, being jumpy when the phone beeps, a text message, you know, basically super gluing the phone to their hand so that they're never without the phone. So just some subtle changes in their behaviour, and investigate it and make sure that you don't start every conversation with a negative. We know that kids are loath often to tell parents if they're having a problem online because they fear losing access. Everything that comes out of mum's mouth is, oh, Facebook this, Facebook that, the internet's bad. If you turned it off, you wouldn't have a problem.
So parents should be more aware of their children's needs in respect to being connected, but work with them rather than frighten them away from talking.
If you've started every conversation in the last 6 months with a negative about technology, what right-minded child's going to come and tell you they've got a problem? They're not. So, you know, and parents don't do this intentionally. Like, it's not a case of trying to turn the child off.
But a lot of parents are not as savvy as the kids are in technology anyway. So the parents have an inbuilt fear of technology because they don't understand it.
Yeah, so they need to learn. And it is parenting in the 21st century.
Can I make a point at this point? It's really important. It's the time when parents should be making that effort to learn about technology intervening, learning what the kids are doing online, presumably isn't just when they notice these signs that you've just been talking about with Andrew. This is what every parent needs to be doing.
From about age two onwards, when the child is two, not the parent. But they could start then. But no,
it wouldn't hurt if they did.
From the time your child is very, very young, you need to be up to speed. Don't wait till they're 16 or 17 or when there's a problem.
So what does that mean, being up to speed? Does that mean having a Facebook account so you can be friends with your child? Does it mean understanding how smartphones work, so you know how texts and email, you know, just so how the information can flow, they can understand how they're always connected?
I think it takes all those things. My advice is always, if your child is using an application, like a game, a website, I think you need to be using it too. You need to know what it is, what it does, what the interaction is, and make sure you're happy with all of that and you're happy with the content. You also need to know how the device works. And I don't mean, you know, fix the hard drive on your computer when it sort of decides not to work. I mean the basics. Turn it on, turn it off, set up, look at the security settings, some basic information. As they get older, rules and boundaries are really important, and enforce them, stick to them, and make them realistic. And then when they get older again and they have Facebook, if that's their choice, you need to be there too. Bearing in mind that just being a Facebook friend doesn't necessarily mean your child won't have a problem. But it was interesting, I read a study that came out of the Pew Internet Center. Well, they do all that study stuff in America. And they do great research, probably, you know, cutting-edge stuff. And I was reading a six-page report that came out late last week. And basically, I was saying one of the protective factors for the internet is a connection to a parent. So if your parent is there with you online, the children were more likely to tell an adult that they were having a problem. So I think that's really important. Don't think that you can become a Facebook friend and solve the problems you can't, because, of course, you don't see the inbox messages and things like that. But what you do get is a feel for the wall. You can feel the tone and see what's going on.
A sense of what's happening out there.
Yeah. I mean, don't Facebook stalk your kids. You know, don't be, you know, all your kids' friends' friends. I mean, that's a bit creepy. But, you know, just be there as a person that they can go to. And they know the mere fact that you may be there seeing what they're doing is often a hugely protective factor.
And if parents aren't confident with the technology, and perhaps the kid's got a Facebook page and the parent doesn't yet have one, a parent could ask the child to help them set up their Facebook page and to teach them, and that would be a good way to bond with
Absolutely. I always say to parents, you know, talk about the fact that you're going to get Facebook with your children and ask them to set it up for you. You might have to pay them, sling them a couple of iTunes cards or something, but pay them. But what you do is if the kids go, oh, no, Mum, you're not having Facebook, that's dorky. So that's fine, I'll set it up myself. And I will just set it up myself and I'll put my own
and
photos on.
And then start
on.
To set it up yourself. Be open about the fact that you're struggling and the child will naturally come and help.
Absolutely, because what they don't want...
Yeah.
No. What they don't want is a parent with a dorky Facebook page.
Well, there you go.
So it's reverse psychology. Their child will want to come and help because they don't want the dorky parent on Facebook. They want the groovy parent.
And that's the same thing with games they play online. Show me how to play the game with them, that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. I have parents say to me, oh, you can't play Club Penguin. That's a game for kids. I said who?
Yeah.
But it's a kid's game. Well, it doesn't mean I can't play it. Mm. So understanding what the interaction is. And, of course, when it comes to Facebook, Facebook has a rule that says you have to be 13 to have Facebook. Do not support your child to break the rules. They are there for a very good reason. And you are. What sort of example are you setting if you say, oh, it's okay, you can be 19, who cares?
Valid point. And I guess coming back also to the parents, understanding how all these gadgets work is also really important too, from a personal assistance sort of, you know, PDA type of thing, even to the iPad. You know, so you sort of want to be the dumb person or the dumb parent so that you can find out what your kids know and they sort of participate with you in setting these things up.
I mean, parents take their kids to the park. They walk the dog with them. They go on holidays with them. Do they ever sit down and play a computer game with them? Do they ever chat on MSN or Facebook chat with them? Just be in their world. It's not all bad. Unfortunately, it's you know, you never get the good news stories about technology. And, of course, technology is fabulous. We have to be mindful of the dangers, of course, but don't demonise it. Get in there and hang out with your kids and have a bit of fun.
It is fun. I've started with my 9-year-old. She's pretty good. She likes a little netbook. She gets out there. We're going to do webcam-y thing shortly, just for us, closed circuit. Is that all right? Is webcam okay? What do you think about webcam?
Look, I use Skype routinely.
That's what I was thinking,
yeah. I've got friends overseas.
Yeah.
And Skype set up correctly is relatively safe. But what I see is people go, oh, you do this, and look, wow, magic's happening. But they don't put any security features in. So basically I can type in Bill and every Bill on Skype comes up and I can see who I'd like to chat to. So, again, it's all in the setting up.
And the same applies to FaceTime. This is this new Apple thing with iOS 5 where everyone can now talk to their friend down the road.
I chatted to my son sitting next to me on the computer on that last night with my new iPad. You know, how dorky is that? Like we're going, hi, and we're talking to each other down the iPad.
I love it. You hold them up together and see if they have feedback. Yeah, all that sort of good stuff.
But, you know, it's a bit of fun.
It is.
It's not in place of face-to-face communication. It's together with.
My concern, I guess, from that point of view, is that when kids get it, they disappear off, you know, because they've got their iPod. They're such a small, portable device, and traditionally houses are connected with a wireless network these days. And, of course, the iPods
aren't really much use if they're not connected. They only play music, heaven forbid.
Oh, no, you don't want to do that.
No, you don't want to do that.
Like talk on a phone. Gee whiz, who would have thought that we'd talk on a phone?
Yeah, so you really want to get them down into the living room. And I think I've designed my wireless network at home at the moment so that it only works in certain areas of the house. So when FaceTime happens, when it happens, it's in a place where we know. Yeah.
Technology-enabled devices or computer-enabled devices, you know, need to be in a common area of the house. It's not negotiable. You don't have them in a bedroom.
We were talking about schools a little bit earlier, Susan. Andy in our chat room has asked a question. What are schools doing to stop this sexting business with kids and also, like, cyber security generally? Are they putting programs in place or what's the level of ignorance out
and
there?
And take that a step further. Is there an education system at a school level without you going in and waving the flag?
Yes and no. Some schools have decided that they will teach cyber safety education in whatever form that may take. Others still have their head in the sand and really don't know where to start or perhaps don't want to start. Many, of course, use the programs that I offer and I go into a lot of schools and speak. But one of the good programs that's around at the moment that a lot of schools are signed up to and the state government has provided funds for is the Alana and Madeline Foundation eSmart School Program, which is basically an accreditation program which schools follow. And they basically become an e-smart school. So it's not a program that they run per se, but it's a set of guidelines that if you follow all these guidelines and you implement all these things, you are moving towards a school that essentially is e-smart. And, of course, that includes education for teachers, parents and students, policies, practices and a whole range of other things. So I think as a parent, you have every right to ask your child's school, what are they doing? Where's their policy? And if not, why not?
I guess the challenge is to have a standard there.
Yeah, isn't there really? And that's what eSmart is trying to develop.
Yeah, goes into a certain year level, what they're going to learn, how long it's going to take them to learn specific things. But in terms of e-safety, you need to have a benchmark, don't you?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if we look to the UK in primary schools over there, cyber safety education is a compulsory part of the curriculum. And I would love to see that here.
It would be great. Why shouldn't it be?
Well, that's exactly right. And I know that teachers complain about having to do jobs that the parents, you know, oh, my child can't swim, oh, the teacher will do it. Oh, they can't drive a car, well, the teacher will do that. But technology, I think, is a little bit different because it's inherent in education. Kids are using it every single day in school. It needs to be more than how to use, you know, Word and how to do an Excel spreadsheet and how to play mathletics or something like that. There needs to be what I call digital citizenship, and that needs to focus on the two words of respect and responsibility.
So what else is in store for kids in the next little bit? Anything, any trends that are happening at the moment that are cause for concern adults should be aware of?
Yeah, and one of the latest, we talked about the gossip pages on Facebook, then we went to the Root Rater ones.
Yep.
What has come up recently in the past week or so is groups within Facebook called the Sneaky Hat. And what that is encouraging people to post naked, sexually explicit pictures with their bits covered by a hat. Any sort of hat, big, small, whatever works for you.
So what probably started off as a gimmick and a joke and a bit of fun has now snowballed, has it?
Yeah.
You've got the issues of peer pressure and so on playing a part.
And what you see is when kids get involved in these sort of sites is that not to conform and participate, they're ostracised. So it is used as a form of cyberbullying. Like if you haven't posted a picture on the Sneaky Hat, well, you're not worthwhile.
You're not part of the club.
No, and you know, one of the sites we looked at before, you know, it's got 16,000 members. So, you know, and there are some, you know, that's a fairly general one, but there are some now that are locality and school specific. And again, you know, a lot of people might say, oh, but it's just kids being kids, it's just a bit of fun. But when you're encouraging a child to take a naked picture of themselves, you've got to understand that, you know, we're talking about child pornography here in many forms.
And there are criminal ramifications. It's not just a bit of fun.
You know, the police aren't going to say, oh, you know, that was hysterical, don't do it again. Because one of the things with these offences, unlike many other criminal offences, is there is no discretion. There is no police discretion. There is no judicial discretion. And that's a concern because it's basically applying a law that was not written for a set of circumstances to a set of circumstances, and the consequences often are far more serious than anyone realised.
Is the law keeping up with what's going on at the moment?
Yes and no. I think that, we're really well legislated. If you look at technology misuse, there is a crime there somewhere that we could link it to.
Yep.
A lot of people bemoan the fact that they cannot visually find the words cyber bullying.
Yeah, it's not in any act or any piece of official documentation.
Although it is now in Victorian The Crimes Act Section 21A D, which is colloquially called Brodie's Law, which was the one that was brought in after the suicide of Brodie Panlock, to criminalise workplace bullying so that it became a crime rather than something that was dealt with through a tribunal. But the good thing about Brodie's Law is the fact that it doesn't just cover workplaces, it covers schools as well and students, and it actually talks about cyberbullying. It's punishable with imprisonment of up to 10 years. So it's taken
good
seriously.
Good start. And that's Victoria at the moment, isn't
that
it?
That Brodie's Law is, in fact, Victorian only.
You reckon that'll roll out further into other...
I'd like to think so. I think that it's fabulous, and it's acknowledgement of the damage that cyberbullying does.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mentally and physically.
Susan McLean, thank you very much for coming in this evening.
My pleasure.
It's we could go on with for ages about it. It's very close to my heart with the family at the moment because I've got young girls, and, of course, they like their technology, so you've got to be there with them
absolutely.
All the way through.
Absolutely, and, you know, please, to parents, don't demonise technology. Embrace it the same way as your kids are. I've had to live it. You know, my kids now are, you know, at that upper end of the age, but they all got laptops in year seven. I've had to live it for years and years and years, and the earlier you can start with those rules and boundaries, the better.
For more information, people can go to your website, cybersafetysolutions.com.au. I'll say that again, cybersafetysolutions.com.au for more information. That's Susan McLean's website. And clubs, schools, there's all sorts of resources there for everybody,
isn't there? There's fact sheets, there's information, there's the media, as you said. Further resources to look at, my contact details, anyone wants to contact me, not a problem.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for coming in, Susan. We'll hopefully get you back next year, and we can talk some more about this fairly important social topic for Australia and global ramifications right around the world, because the internet thing's a real biggie. We're going to hear from Adam Turner now. He's got a view from the couch. He's apparently something to do with ultrabooks. These are these new whiz-bang things. We've got to keep up with technology on this show, don't we? So, and when we come back, we're going to have a chat to James Gardner about new things in cinema and cameras and things like that.
Ooh, fantastic.
Yeah, so chat.techtalkradio.com.au if you want. We'll be back with more after this. Adam Turner.
Adam Turner's View from the Couch.
Are ultrabooks merely super cool fashion accessories, or are they here to stay? Remember back when netbooks were all the rage? They seemed impossibly small and light, not to mention super cool and super cheap, compared to traditional mobile computing devices. Netbooks didn't pack a lot of grunt, but that didn't really matter to people who were just looking to tackle day-to-day computing tasks on the run. Then Apple's super cool iPad came along and pretty much blew the netbook out of the water, impressing the latte drinkers while once again revolutionising the concept of mobile computing. Netbook makers fought back by adding extra bells and whistles, but all this did was drive up the bulk and the price tag. I'd say high-end netbooks lost their way once they started to rival the size and price of traditional notebooks while still offering a tiny 10-inch display. Now, PC makers are having another crack at the mobility space with ultrabooks, an Intel trademark referring to super thin, super cool notebooks which aim to be highly portable without sacrificing too much in the way of functionality and grunt. They're less than 20mm thick and weigh in at under 1.5 kilos using a solid-state drive and ditching the optical drive. Yet these ultrabooks feature Intel's low-voltage Core i5 and Core i7 processors, which is designed to push the battery life out past 5 hours. You've got 13-inch displays as well, which puts them clearly in notebook territory. I think such a screen size and the all-important corresponding keyboard size strikes a better balance between portability and usability than a 10-inch netbook. Of course, Apple's 11 and 13-inch MacBook Airs probably also fit the description of ultrabooks, although it's not a phrase you'll ever hear Apple use. To be honest, I was surprised to see Apple produce the 11-inch MacBook Air, considering that it's actually one of the best netbooks around, even though Apple would never ever call it a netbook and tried so hard to avoid the netbook space. Just like Apple's super cool MacBooks, these new ultrabooks aren't cheap. So far, we've got Australian pricing on the Toshiba Satellite Z830 and the ASUS ZenBook, which are both $1,399. Then you've got the Acer Aspire S3 at $1,199. We're still waiting to hear about Lenovo's new IdeaPad Ultrabook. At these prices, you're paying almost 100% premium for portability and style,
considering you can find plenty of similar spec bog-standard 15-inch notebooks for under $700. I've spent some time with the Toshiba Satellite Z830, and it's amazingly petite. It doesn't sacrifice much in the way of features or grunt. It's only 15.9 millimeters thick and tips the scales at 1.12 kilos, enough to turn any road warrior's head in his favorite cafe. Don't be too fooled by the netbook-esque physique. This Z830 sports a glossy 13.3-inch LED display. It packs a Core i5 processor, 4GB of RAM and 128GB solid-state drive. It also runs a full version of Windows Home 7 Premium, none of this Windows Starter rubbish. Despite its lightweight design, the Z830 is surprisingly well-balanced and doesn't feel in danger of tipping backwards even when sitting on your lap or balanced next to a latte on a coffee table. The magnesium alloy casing helps keep the weight down, but the display has a disturbing amount of flex and twist in it. There's no optical drive as to be expected, but turn over the Z830 in your hands and you'll discover USB, Ethernet, HDMI, VGA and SD ports. Pretty much everything you'd want on the run. Under light load, you'll squeeze about 5 hours of the Z830, but if you're looking to milk every last drop, you can press the Eco Mode button, which dims the screen, sets more aggressive idle times and kills the keyboard backlight. Unfortunately, the Z830 is marred by a very disappointing keyboard, with squat keys creating an unnecessarily cramped keyboard. Considering that it's a 13-inch notebook rather than a 10-inch netbook, I don't see why we should have to make that kind of a sacrifice. For me, this meant that the Z830 made a rather disappointing first impression, but obviously that won't bother everyone. Of course, we're still talking about a $1,399 price tag, which would almost get you a 13-inch MacBook Air. At these prices, Ultrabooks are designed for road warriors and fashionistas, not people looking for basic notebooks to live on their desk or the kitchen table. Even so, Intel hopes that 40% of consumer notebook sales will be Ultrabooks by the end of 2012. It sounds a little optimistic to me, and we've heard such bold predictions before. So you've got Ultrabooks wedged in between notebooks and netbooks whilst fighting off the tablet threat as well. I'm still not convinced there's a future for them, but they look super cool, and I guess that's all that matters to some people.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Ah, yes, you are. Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio, everybody. I'm Andrew McComb. Thank you very much to Susan McLean for joining us this evening. So much more we could talk about, but obviously time has not been of the essence this evening because we have lots of guests in this evening as we ramp up our shows towards the end of the year. We've got three to go, including tonight, so we've got our best of coming up fairly shortly after that. But in the meanwhile, interesting things have been happening this week. Microsoft revises forced reboots in Windows 8. Did you hear about this, Graham? Microsoft has flagged major changes to how it will deliver software updates in Windows 8 and plans to cut pop-up notifications and prevent data loss caused by forced reboots and things like that. Now, you're running Windows 8 as a little plaything on one of your devices at the moment.
Yeah, running it in a virtual machine, so I don't leave it running all the time, so I haven't seen the differences, but presumably this is...
Well, according to some blog posts this week, things like forcing users to restart their machines every time an update is downloaded is sort of not going to be an issue these days.
No, well, I don't know how many. Now? Yeah, I don't know how many times I've left something running on my machine. I leave my machine running 24/7,
and I'll wake up in the morning and it's done itself.
I'll often leave things open and leave things in little text boxes that I've want to remember from one day to the next, and I'll wake up the next morning and the machine's loaded an update and rebooted itself overnight, and it's all gone back to zero.
Fantastic. So that's why it should be. Yeah. I've got a big one sitting there waiting at work at the moment. It's not 100 odd
meg download. It's annoying to have the machine reboot. So yeah, if they're finding ways to load updates, you could load an update to most parts of Windows and just restart that part of Windows without having to restart all of it. Then that would make a lot more sense.
Makes good sense, in fact. All right.
Lena's just joined.
Sorry.
In other news this week, Telstra is they use 1800 meg or 1.8 gig, which is one of the mobile phone bands. The numbers really don't make much difference, except for the fact that LTE in other countries is 1900 meg, which I've been doing a bit of reading about. So as a result, the new fast internet and new fast data packs that LTE offers, obviously different hardware in Australia because there's not much in the 1800 meg spectrum for devices.
Well, so, there's not much in devices anywhere in the world so far, as far as I know.
HTC are about to launch a new handheld device, which Dr. Ron was going to talk about later on this evening, I think. So there's a new device coming out in that particular part of the world. But I've read a few articles and I've read a few people's blog posts that they're getting pretty amazing speeds down on LTE, especially in some of the city centres. But I guess that's because they're the only people using the cells at the moment,
you know,
aren't they?
What bugs me, and I'm going to get in trouble for saying this.
Oh, no, I do anyway.
It's Telstra calling it 4G when it isn't.
Well, it's not just Telstra, it's the rest of the world.
Hmm.
It is. I went into a Telstra shop the other day and used the word LTE, and I was corrected, 4G. Can you believe it?
Well, no, I would have stuck to my guns and said, no, it's not 4G according to the rules, it's LTE, yeah.
I did. I also quizzed the guy about what frequencies they used, and he didn't know. So, obviously, they're well-informed, all of those guys.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so... all right. So what else is happening this week? Lots of things we've got to touch on to gloss over. Obviously, pay TV is really kicking off big time at the moment, and the demand for video over things like fibre networks, ADSL, over almost anything is pretty demanding. Fetch TV, obviously, is Optus's offering through providers like iiNet and the likes. Telstra's going to put $100 million into video distribution, which is also going to be quite interesting over the next little bit. And the investment was announced as part of the restructure of the carrier's media business, because don't forget, they have Big Pond TV and Foxtel and all sorts of stuff. So we're starting to see the competition really start to ramp up. Now, Graham, you're a big fan of this sort of stuff because you don't have a TV antenna anymore, do you?
Not plugged in, no.
And how have you found, like, just on the whole, getting material in, getting content in over those great new devices? Is it good? Is it
I've got lots of content on DVD and on Blu-ray. I've got games that I play now that Lena's turned me into a gamer.
Woohoo!
I've got things like ABC iView. I can keep up with things that way. Everyone's got their catch-up TV service now. It does work, yeah.
Yeah, it's very good. You just need the bandwidth to go with it.
And you can watch the hamster wheel. The hamster wheel doesn't suffer from being watched online at all.
I do. That's an ABC program, the Chaser Boys.
Yes.
Suffers from very some good other stuff. Things, though, doesn't it?
Does it? What would that be?
I'm rather enjoying
it. The writing, maybe?
Oh, you think? Hey, well, I think they're doing better than they were in their previous suit.
Yeah, that's true. I'll give them that.
Since you found a microphone.
Yay!
Yay!
Just briefly.
Tech Talk Games with Lena Van Deventer.
Briefly.
Guys, we've got so much to get through.
You know how we've got Steam?
That got hacked, yeah.
Yes, we'll ignore that for now until I know more about it.
I've ignored it, yep.
Steam is on Windows and Mac.
Yes.
But it's not on Linux yet.
Oh, isn't it?
And there's been rumours about that happening for a few years now, but Valve haven't really done anything.
The makers of Steam haven't.
So, Desura have come in.
Ah, third party.
Yes, yeah. as a digital distribution client that's now available on Linux.
Ah.
Which is kind of cool. They have a focus on, they're not saying that they're a competitor to Steam, but they do deliver vaguely the same thing, but they have more of a focus on indie games and the modding community a little bit.
Okay.
So excellent. That's happening there.
So Linux is looking promising.
Yes. For gamers who run Linux, you can game more now, which is great. Gaming frequently changes your brain, Andrew.
I know. Look at Dr. Ron.
Yeah, I can see
it. He's spent all day on the computer, haven't you?
I think that Lena's game recommendations need to come with a Surgeon General's warning. Like that, what you have on the cigarette packets.
Next they'll come in plain paper wrapping.
Yeah, they need to. Lena's game recommendations will kill you. They will cause your family to bust up. They will seriously impact
the dog will put on a lot of weight.
All I can say is Minecraft on Lena's recommendation, and I am obsessed.
How good is it?
It's pretty good.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm not going to go there.
It's very addictive.
It's a time sink.
Oh.
Yeah, it's definitely a time sink. But yes, your brain is changing is changing the more you play Minecraft. A study has found that the brains of teenagers, or maybe not you, when were you a teenager?
Oh, I'm just turned 20, so this last year.
Not that long ago. Who frequently play games tend to have a larger, more productive region associated with rewarding sensations.
Yeah, it's me.
So it's sort of it's not immediately clear whether it's good news or bad news for us enlarged-brained folk, this was a study from Ghent University in Belgium.
So what are you saying here, that if we play lots of games, we become more like a carrot-driven sort of person?
Yeah, and we don't know whether that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing for us as gamers. We have an enlarged left ventral striatum, which I'm sure I'm saying that wrong.
That'll hit the promo.
That's the brain's reward center that deals with dopamine dispersal. Sorry.
Disposal too,
not
probably.
Disposal, dispersal. it's not sure whether that's good for us. It's good for researchers who can use this discovery to study the impact of addiction and its effect on the brain, but without having to introduce neurotoxic substances to the test subjects in order to do it. So it's a way that we can sort of safely, you know, see how addiction messes with our brains, which is kind of cool.
Wow. So Dr. Ron's candidate?
Perhaps.
He's addicted?
I don't think he's addicted, no.
Oh, he said it was addictive. Sorry.
Yeah. They're different things. And luckily he didn't say addicting, or I would have to hurt him, because that is a word that people keep using that's not actually...
A word.
Addicting.
It's so frustrating.
Why don't you start it? Put it up on Wiki and away you go. Addicting.
No, I don't like it. It sounds wrong. It's like ironical.
Ugh. Ironical. That's terrible.
Graham's cringing
well.
In the corner.
You might fall down soon. Unfortunately, bad gaming news. Unity, which is a game engine, won't be coming to Windows Phone 7. So, personally, I think this is the nail in the coffin to Windows Phone 7.
Really?
As a gaming platform.
Yeah, it was going well up until this point.
Well, it wasn't, but, you know, it was maybe perhaps the last nail in the coffin, of which there were many. It's a closed system in terms of it has to be – all the games and apps for Windows Phone 7 need to be based on XNA or Silverlight. And this means no room for games made with Unity, unfortunately. And,
whose decision was that?
This is Windows making this decision. Microsoft making this decision. It'll never, ever compete with iPhone and Android phones as a gaming platform if they're not going to allow Unity, which is one of the major 3D game engines.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Correct.
That was a big deal. And I went to GCAP. I'm
yeah,
very
you were
excited.
Saying.
I mentioned
yeah.
it at the start
you did.
Of the show, but I'm so excited.
I like seeing you excited.
We learnt...
you launched a massive tweet storm
I
last
did.
Week. What happened?
I apologise. Now, normally I say I don't tweet too much, but over
there's
GCAP,
nothing unusual about that, is there, Dr. Ron?
I tweeted up a storm, an absolute storm, but it's because I was so excited.
Did you actually communicate with anyone, or were you too busy tapping away on your phone?
No, I did. That's the great thing about these sorts of conferences is when you're in a conference and people are looking at their phone, they're normally bored, but at these things... they're taking part in a conversation on Twitter or, you know, on the hashtag, or they're reading what people are saying on their phones while the discussion's going on, which is really fascinating. It's like this sort of meta conversation going on at the same time as
Twitter's
as
got a lot to answer
thing.
For, hasn't it?
Yeah, I found it fascinating to watch the hashtag and see everything going and to contribute and watch yourself get retweeted if someone agrees with you. And it was all sort of a...
It's all about the ego.
It was just... No. It was just that it's nice to know that someone thinks the same you do at some point in that kind of conference.
I'm going out on a limb here. I'm going to press the button. Boof. Oh, thank God someone agreed with me.
Pretty much. Good. I didn't annoy anyone too much. Day one was a forum on serious games. Now, this doesn't mean just ones that aren't fun.
Yeah.
This means games that are used more than just for entertainment purposes, so mainly in, like, training and education. Industries that use serious games is, like, defense, health, emergency services, and mining education, believe it or not. They use...
Minecraft.
Yeah. That's some mining education.
It's mining education.
You have to leave in a minute.
Training product.
If you use a wooden pickaxe,
he's addicted.
It will degrade faster.
Addicted?
Then addicting. Don't say addicting. I'll have to hurt
it's
you.
It's very addicting.
They were talking basically about the importance of simulation in games to train and retain information, which was really fascinating. I'd never really thought about games in that way before.
Okay.
And it broke my brain a little bit in the good way.
Well, you're here still. That's the main thing.
It didn't break it too bad.
No, it's good.
It was a bit of a scary...
have you written about it? Can people read your antics?
They are about to, yes. They're
about
soon.
To. Where will they be able to read it?
I can't say yet.
Oh, no. Sorry.
But when...
Just watch. Just subscribe to tweet...
Yeah.
Lena's Twitter feed. You'll find out.
When I know about it, you'll know about it. Associate Professor Marcus Watson was talking in the health section on the Serious Games Forum about how healthcare professionals can have a 100% retention rate in their training... and then go down to 17% in a month's time.
Wow, that's a lot.
That's scary. There was a lot of statistics he had that had a lot of us quivering in our pants, I'll tell you that. Because it was, he said an iPhone or an iPad game can easily be made to for them to pick up and help their training along the way. Sort of, so if you pick up an iPhone, you're going to remember your training a bit more through a game or something than you are.
Than you are than if you just learn it to pass an exam and then you forget it.
Exactly. Games are fun. Yeah. If you learn through games, then it's fun.
Exactly. And if you do the same thing over and over again, it sticks in your brain. And,
oh, repetition.
And if you make it fun, then you want to do it over and over again, don't you? So it's
lots of things in life apply to that.
Yeah. And that was basically a similar thing to defence. You can't carry a mock town around with you to practice in.
No, you can't.
If you're an FBI agent. You can't have, you know, a simulation needing 20 other people involved and lots of money and time and a physical space to train in.
Next thing you're going to tell us, you met a real live FBI agent.
I did. Randy Pargman from the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Is that his real name?
Yes, that is his real name.
No.
He told us.
Call that person Randy.
Agent Johnson and Special Agent Johnson.
Yep. Yeah. It's actually on his business card. No, he relation. Is a game designer for the FBI, a game developer for the FBI. And he makes all these
That's
these
pretty cool. Does games. He carry a gun?
No, he does not carry a gun because he's a game developer.
Does he carry a DS or something?
Probably.
Carry a Wiimote or something.
Yeah, exactly.
In a holster.
Freeze talking.
And he was telling us how he uses games to train agents how to appropriately treat crime scenes, which is a really big deal. It's something that can make or break an entire case. So if you don't harvest the evidence perfectly, the defence can declare it inadmissible in court. So you could really get in a lot of trouble by not putting your glove on or not doing this or not doing that or, you know.
Did you say, I've played L.A. Noir, I know all this stuff.
Exactly.
This is all old hat.
You pick up a beer bottle and you turn it left and you turn it right and that's how it works.
That's how you solve the crime.
Is that how it works?
Yeah.
All in a video game.
But that was day one. So that was the more brain food than the rest of the days, but I could go on forever and ever and ever. But it was fantastic time.
What do you
time.
Mean you could?
I know. I'm sorry. But there was, I will write about it, and if anyone has any questions,
write
in.
I look forward to reading
about
it. And Dr. On's habits with Minecraft.
Yes.
Won't that be good?
It will.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
Tech Talk Radio.
James Gardner joins us now. You finally got here, James.
Yes, I did.
He's been here all evening. You've heard his voice. Hang on. Dr. Ron, can you clap for the camera for a sync point for the audio?
I can, as long
we've got a camera here.
There we go.
Fantastic. Done. James joins us from Digital.
That's right. My company's Digital, and my company works in doing technology and software and IP for the cinema industry.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd come in again today because there's been a lot of very interesting developments in the technology for cinema. I think it's one of the most exciting times in cinema for a very long time.
I have to agree with you on that. There's some good stuff out there at the moment.
It's amazing stuff.
3D's been and gone now, so what have we got?
Yeah, that's just absolutely quite true. What we've got now is just straight away, first off, it's quite astounding how much passion goes into the toys people use to shoot movies.
Absolutely.
It's quite amazing when that is only a very, very, very small part of making a movie, like getting people to work together and getting, you know, a crew of 50 or people to shoot a film, etc. Some people would think that's probably a more important thing, but people seem to concentrate on the cameras, etc. And recently, two new cameras were released. You mentioned one last week, which was the C300.
Yeah, this is the Canon device, which comes in two flavors, one with the PL mounts and one with the XF mounts, which is traditional, just standard Canon lenses that fits on the front of them.
Which That's one's right. yummier?
Depends on which glass you own. It's really they do that because there's a lot of old glass out there, and that's actually more of an investment than buying the actual recording device in the long run.
Yeah.
But in terms of the cameras, the exciting part of it is that these cameras are bringing the cost of making film or the quality on the screen down for that part of the whole, you know, the it's quite a complicated thing to do, and it's bringing that part down to a very cost effective amount. Now, the C300 from Canon was very big affair because it's based on, everyone knows, the 5D Mark II, which everyone's going on about. It's
yeah, these are digital SLR cameras, which have been out on the market for some time, the 5D in particular.
But they can shoot video, not just
pictures. There's a 7D, which does the same. Well, a lot of them do these days, but some better than others.
And just to give you an example of that, for example, there's quite a number of the highbrow series, like, for example, House. House has been predominantly shot on a 5D today. And lots of other, you know, instead of using these hundreds of thousands of dollar cameras, we're using $5,000 cameras instead. Now, the 5D is not completely suited for that in the terms of form factor, so the Canon brought out the C300, which is much more suited to it. And it's a $15,000, so it's a big price jump from the 5D.
But it's more suited for shooting that sort of thing, because the way it takes the image and squeezes it down, it doesn't do line skipping or these other techniques which cause anti-aliasing on edges and sharpness issues, etc., which if you really want to get technical in the 5D. And this camera avoids that sort of scenario. It uses a more common codec, which is a 422 MPEG to 50 megabit and all this sort of high-end jargon, etc.
How does the price compare, James, with what was used previously?
Well, it's fantastic price. The only real big issue here is that at the same day, a few hours later after they announced that, everyone's heard of Red Cinema or the Red Camera.
Well, some people haven't, but Red's another competitor in that same market. Red cameras have been around for a while. A lot of feature films get shot on them.
Yes.
Yep.
And anyway, the Red Camera, or they brought out this new camera called the Epic, which is a 5K camera bay filter, and it's doing very well. The Hobbit's been shot on it, Spider-Man 4, or the new Spider-Man, and lots of big features you've seen lately have been shot on this camera, and the workflow is there, it's mature, and it's been giving us fantastic results. Well, Red, just after Canon released their camera, released what's called the Scarlett. Now, the Scarlett was supposed to be this very inexpensive camera, but I think they ran out of time or whatever. They couldn't really get it right. So
pressures, maybe.
That's right. Yeah. And what they ended up doing is basically selling the Scarlett chip, knobbled down, in the Scarlett for $10,000.
Well, even still, a $10,000 camera for indie developers and stuff, like Lena speaks a lot of indie game developers, mm-hmm. And obviously we know how financially challenged indie game developers are. Well, let me tell you, it's the same applies for indie film developers as well. And this is where these optional cameras come in, because traditionally everyone uses the Arris and all the big, you know, the Panavision cameras. That's and right. stuff like that, which is traditionally, you know, the very expensive productions. But we've got this next level of cameras coming down, which started with the DSLRs, the digital single lens reflex cameras. And Canon have really got that market by the short and curlies, because we've had the 1D out for a while, and now more commonly it's the 5D and the 7Ds, which the bodies of those cameras you pick up for sub $2,000, I think, right, these days. Mm. And then it all comes down to the quality of the lenses, the glass that you put on them. And this is where I think Canon have really competed with Sony's F3, which we spoke about probably 6 months back when that came out. And you can actually use the glass or your lens from your digital SLR camera on one of these now motion picture cameras, that's the right, C300. Yes. And I think that's a great resource, because a lot of cinematographers are starting to use these devices. We have one here in the studio this evening. And it's just the next extension. It's going the next level. How do they go up on cinema? Have you seen them transcoded and...
To tell you the truth, in my opinion, anything shooting like that, like a Red or et cetera, going through a DI, going to screen, looks better than film has in a long time.
Wow. That's a big call.
My opinion, it does. Film has a lot of issues in the way you use it and what you want to do with it. And digital can basically imitate everything that film does in today's, you know, the advances of the fire, of the Red, etc. But the problem is that you actually have to know how to use them correctly to obtain what you want onto the screen. And the big thing about film was far more forgiving, and probably still is to digital to a degree. So it's more, if you know what you're doing with digital, usually you can take it further than film can, even in today with the Red and the other digital cameras out there. But you just need to know what you're doing. It's like the old days of and, you know, when you went from analog recording in audio to digital recording in audio. In the old days, you used to record them quite hot and it would be all fine, etc. In the digital days, you actually need to make sure you never get anywhere near the hot, or you never want to peak at all, because it's just the end of it.
Digital stuff gets distorted and that's the end of it.
That's right. And it's very similar in digital video. You want to shoot it so it's very flat, it's a little bit dark, and when you actually see it raw on a screen on the set, it looks terrible. Doesn't look like anything you really want. Because it's been shot in a way that, you know, when you go through post, you can pull out the data that you want is there.
Post-production, yes.
But in post is where you decide how you're going to pull out that data and make the picture look like you want to on screen.
Well, that's very important, because a lot of today's modern editing facilities have what we call colour correction in them.
That's right.
And it's those colour correcting software packages, which are part of the main editing packages traditionally, where you can pull it all apart and make things more colourful or do all those special effects. And it's like being able to, you know, the raw footage that when you take a snap with these cameras, you get a raw file, which you can then put into your photographic software and like re-expose it again.
That's right.
As if you were there taking the photo again. You can do those sort of same sort of things in post.
Do that with video, can you, as well?
Well, you can.
Yes. Now, I want to get into when I want to talk about the C300 and the Red, I want to jump into a quite a technical reason about what the difference is and why they're important to us as cinema owners.
Now,
the big thing about what people wanted film for was the latitude, right? Now, the latitude is basically how much colour information you store when you record the image. Now, film being an analog process can store its, next to infinity because it's an analog based process. But we can only really record, everything go through a DI and it eventually go through some sort of filter.
What's a DI? Just for those not using
a DI means that you get the recorded medium and you put it into some sort of digital format through different digital processing. Through the years, it's improved with the amount of color information you can record. Now, let's have a quick lesson in color information. Like, if you go to a typical image that you see on your screen, like a JPEG image on a website, that's usually an 8-bit RGB color, right? Now, 8-bit RGB color means there's 256 colors between like black and white, and we can actually see that if we really look hard, we can see the slight differences in the banding between the colors.
Normally, in a sky. When you get those beautiful blue skies where you go from a dark blue to a light blue, that's normally
that's right.
where I sort of
and
see
it. And typical, if you get it recorded on a typical video recorder and they record the sky, a handy cam,
yep.
which is recording in typical 8-bit YUV color, you will actually be able to see banding across the sky, right?
Yep.
Now,
you never got that in analog, did you?
Not really, but there's other reasons why I didn't get it called temporal.
Let's not go there.
Yeah, okay.
So that's where you have the contrast. Like, there's almost no contrast at all. It's a very, very gradual change of colour from one side of the picture to the other.
That's right. So if we say typical
colours... I'm speaking in layman's terms because I'm a layman when it comes to this stuff.
Ask questions.
Typical, if we look at it back in 8-bit, right, that's RGB, what we see on most computer screens.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going into any post facility and stuff like that, we're actually trying to do this properly so we've got all the information there. It usually jumps up to at least 10-bit and possibly more. Right.
So the more bits, the better.
The more bits, the better, because every time you add a bit, you double the amount. So if you go to 9-bit, it's double 256. If you go to 10-bit, it's double 256, double that again, which is like so many times more than what you've got with the 8-bit. You've actually got enough room to actually not be able to see the color differences or the banding because there's so many colors there, but you've also got enough room to actually move it around a bit so you actually see the definition. Or if you want to see, for example, into the shadows, you can actually bring the information in the shadows out and make it viewable on screen.
But if you wanted to edit that and say bring it up to 10-bit or 12-bit or something, it has to be recorded at that level, doesn't it? Because you can't invent stuff that's not there. You can't invent information that doesn't exist.
And CSI says you can.
Yeah, but
you and your FBI
people now, go away.
And that's where when you say raw capture, usually raw captures are doing it at 12-bit or even possibly more.
Okay.
And that's why you have so much information there, like you were saying there, Andrew, you can basically type of re-expose the picture. Basically, you're telling the algorithm which pulls that raw data and turns it into a color space which you're used to in the computer, and it makes a decision on how you're going to pull that out. And in reality, it's sort of re-exposing the picture in the way that comes out in the way that you want it to come out. And that's how, for example, the RED camera works. It records in RAW, a compressed version of RAW, which is four times the bandwidth, which is I know that the C300 is 50 megabit a second. The RED Scarlett can do 200 or 400 megabits a second.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
When you think about today's... How would that compare with the average DV camera in respect to data rates? That'd be 25. Less than FireWire, wouldn't it? It'd be really...
I think it was 25.
Yeah.
So we're talking about 400.
Yeah.
But we are doing HD.
Yeah. Am I right in saying that the downside recording in that resolution is that it uses an enormous amount of storage space, whether it's to...
How much is a 2-gig hard drive?
Well, it depends before or after the floods.
So I would have thought you'd be talking like, not gigabytes, I thought you'd have been talking terabytes, like hundreds of terabytes of data if you're shooting for hours on end.
Well, a typical film would be, it's not really my area, but I understand that a typical film these days would be like, 15 to 25 terabytes in required space for doing the whole post-process, special effects and everything for a film, which is quite a lot, but it's not... It's not
unmanageable, I guess.
Well, your average storage these days in these places are 40, 60, 80. There's plenty of space. It's not really an issue these days.
I was thinking more from the point of view of the camera or the recording device. When you're out on location and you're shooting this sort of stuff, you've got to have a recorder, a portable recorder that will write those sorts of volumes.
Well, so on the C300, there's I think the typical SSD. SD card, I forget from memory, it's a domestic type thing, and on the Red camera they have actually purpose-built high-performance SSD drives in, built into mags.
Solid-state disk drives, yeah, SSD.
That's yep. right. So 250 gig for, I don't know, is it 10 or 20 minutes. So it's still, you're storing a lot, you know, that's a lot of data.
Mm. It is 250 gigabytes for 20 minutes
I think it's off the top of my head, but it's still a lot, and that's why I think the Red, which is a cut down of the Scarlett, I think if I had a choice and I was an independent filmmaker, I'd probably go towards the Red because it does record in 4K RAW, so you can actually make a better decision on how you're going to use that and make a better result if you're going to cut into the image. While the C300, they say they're going to upgrade it because it's actually got a 4K sensor, but currently it'll only output to 2K.
We're using 4K, we're using 2K. Can you explain to the listeners again, what are you talking about when it comes to 4K? Maybe put into perspective to standard def and HD.
Okay, strangely enough, like, standard def is 1920 by 1080, right?
That we're talking pixels. So if you get your Photoshop and you open it up and it says, how big do you want
That's right. So if you get a good 23-inch screen for your computer these days, usually they are all 1920 by 1080.
Yeah, we've all seen those numbers on the spec sheet, haven't we? Yeah.
So the quality of that screen is pretty much the quality of HD. You can get up real close and see the pixel sizes, etc. Mm-hmm. Now, 2K is basically 2048 by 858 for widescreen, or 1080 by, it's actually 1998 by 1080 for...
You can round here. Yeah. You're amongst friends.
Yeah, they're very close. And to a degree, I heard when I was talking to other people in Hollywood, some friends over there, one of the main reasons they made it, because it's so close to HD, you say, why didn't you use HD? Well, they made it different for the sake of making it different so it was harder to do pirating and other bits and pieces so they could make the work for it. Yeah, right. Yeah, no, it's true.
Yeah, look, I believe you. Anything at Hollywood, yeah.
But, you know, it's all... As a post person, I think it's a bit silly, but... So then the 4K is basically double 2K, which is...
So it's twice as big.
Twice as big across and down.
For the same resolution, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's four times the resolution of 2K because it's twice as big this way and that way. So it's a lot more data. When you're most films still go to a 2K release, but people are starting to push into 4K because all the DCI equipment now that's out there, which I spoke about last time, is pretty much 4K capable. If the projector's not capable yet, it just... downsizes it in real time to 2K anyway, or if you do have all the full workflow from the player to the projector as 4K, you will see 4K on screen now. There is equipment you can see out there. There's not many in Australia yet, but there's a few coming now.
So your average cinema is still 2K in these new digital screens.
That's right. And most of them will be, and a few of them will be upgrading the larger screens because it's the larger screens that really take advantage of the 4K because you can't really see the 4K on screen if you're sitting at the premium, you know, the correct distance from the screen at the correct, etc. You won't actually see that. You can't really see because your eyes can't really pick up that detail at that distance. But if you've got someone sitting in the third row at the front, then it will make a difference to them, especially on larger screens.
So putting the... Obviously, 2K is what we see in the screens. Now, most of these cameras we've spoken about tonight, the
C300?
Yeah, the new C300 from Canon. Obviously, the F3 from Sony can do it, and the Scarlett can do that. So you've got a tool... sub $20,000 camera, which is really, hiring that's relatively cheap compared to the Arris and the Panavisions and stuff like that. So hopefully we're going to see the independent filmmakers be able to utilize that. And of course, these great things, as I point to a 7D in the corner over here, they're absolutely fantastic for those guys. And you can get rolling on those for next to nothing, really.
That's right, yes. And I know a number of, if we're going to talk about productions, the 550s and the 550Ds and the 60Ds, which are like...
Now, they're earlier model.
They're a little earlier, but they're still current model.
Yeah, Canon cameras,
And we're talking about bodies which are worth $600-$700.
Dr. Ron's got one of those, haven't you? Dr. Ron, you've got a 660, haven't you?
I've got a C400D.
A 400, is it? Yeah.
Anyway, those cameras pretty much are very similar to the quality of the 7D, probably not slightly as light sensitive, but they've actually been adopted by a lot of feature films. You know, in the old days, you'd get these special, very small 35mm cameras. They'd stick them in the corner of cars to do those really difficult shots, or they're going to put them in on a car which they're going to crash, right? So the camera most likely is a write-off. Well, that's all changed to 550Ds and 60Ds. They just, we'll just get a 20 of them and we'll just blow them up as we need them. They're that cheap.
Yeah.
And that's sort of some of the other changes, and that's happening in the top tier of the market as well.
It'd be nice to have a budget like that, wouldn't it?
That's right. Now, let's move on to the advantage of digital, and I'm a big fan of faster frame rates.
Oh, for the slow-mos. We all love slow-mos, don't we? There's a beer ad going around doing those, aren't they?
Well, I want faster frame rates typically in the cinema. I think as a person who's seen a bit of this, etc., that 3D is great, etc., but 3D is going from...
Is it? Sorry, moving on.
Yeah. Some people don't like it, and for good reasons, but 3D brings back the quality of what's on screen a lot from what we used to in terms of 14-foot Lamberts on screen, very bright, very clear. And 3D, the standard is only 3.5-foot Lamberts on screen.
Now, that's brightness, isn't it?
That's right.
And the brightness of the screen.
That's right. So when you can do a 3D and you're looking at through your glasses, it's exceedingly less bright than a typical film would be. And it makes it very difficult for in lots of different reasons. One of the main reasons is that brightness, you know, in your eye there's cones, there's rods and cones.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I remember that from science, yes.
That's right. Well,
cornea and whatnot.
That's right. Well,
cataracts? Sorry.
Hopefully not.
At different light levels, you have the rods or cones coming in into action because they pick up light at different more effectively than the other, right? And at that low light level of 3.5-foot Lamberts, you're actually in the transitional spot where the rods could be working or the cones could be working. And that's why they need to actually regrade the film specifically. If you're 3.5-foot Lamberts, in IMAX they go up to 6-foot Lamberts. And James Cameron wants to go to 10-foot Lamberts because he thinks that looks the best.
James Cameron, the director of... The
Titanic.
The blue guys.
Yeah, the blue. Oh. Yeah, the Smurfs. No.
The bad news. And this is the really indictable state of cinema in this planet.
What have you done?
I didn't do anything. He's looking at me like I did something
Titanic,
wrong.
Titanic is getting a re-release.
Woohoo!
In 3D.
Oh, no!
In 3D?
Yeah. Why do you think he's re-releasing?
That's it. I'm never going to the cinema again, except to see Ticker Tail, Soldier Spy, which has been delayed in this country, but then again, that's another story.
We all know what happens. The ship hits an iceberg.
Yeah, and it sinks.
Spoilers? Jeez.
Oh, God. Go and...
Anyway, so we want more light for 3D, and... I agree with that. I've seen some test screenings of it, and it does look much better, and I'm actually more liking it in terms of... I'm with you, Andrew. I'm not a big fan of 3D, but in some areas it does work.
Yeah.
But I'm a bigger fan of faster frame rates. If you see a fight scene at 60 frames compared to just a typical 24 frame a second, it's like... Because I'm rather old, I was there when THX was installed and Dolby Digital came to the cinemas. And I went there, is this cinema in Dolby Digital? Yes, and sat in and you listened there and you really felt the difference. The sound was remarkably
better. They've taken that off
better.
The DVDs now, haven't they? We don't get the whooshy thing that Dolby Digital's in the front.
Yeah,
anymore.
I get them on some of them or they've changed them.
Well, not in the Blu-rays anyway.
Anyway, so that I think faster frame rates is that sort of jump to me. It's the same but better. 3D is like 3D. It's not as bright, and I don't think it's got some negatives as well as some advantages.
Yeah.
But faster frame rates is the same, but better. Now, there's a lot of people who are against faster frame rates because it looks like video, because you are actually taking pictures at like 24 frames a second, 1/24th of a second per frame, for example, or close to that. If you're going to 60 frames a second, you have to start at 60 frames a second or faster to take the images when you're recording 60 frames a second. So it looks more strobey like a video camera looks. So the people in the industry don't like the look.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That's one thing I noticed on television a few years back. They started doing that sort of thing with sport, like at the Olympics and stuff, and you actually saw like downhill skiing or something, and you didn't have that blur in the motion anymore. It was all very, very strobey, and I didn't really like it, to be honest. It took a lot of getting used to.
If you see it, it looks good. I saw some fight scenes at 60 frames that James did in the test, and it looked fantastic, especially in 3D, because it did more look like looking for a window, especially at 10-foot Lamberts. And The Hobbit is 48 frames a second.
That's going to be good.
Soon.
I'm looking forward to that.
Everyone's looking forward to see exactly...
New Zealand. They do it well.
Yes.
Vita.
I think it'll change the industry, because once the public sees faster frame rates, it'll become very important. The only thing that's stopping it really is that the distributors aren't having enough problems getting to digital, and they're not really that interested in it yet. So it's going to probably take a while to get there.
James, what's your website if people want to find out more about current cinema technology?
Well, I do a website called CineTech Geek.
It's your blog, isn't it, that you do all your best work on, isn't it? Is that the CineTech Geek one?
CineTech Geek's where I do my video blogs, which is mostly about that. I have another blog, which is just me rambling on about things. I like to get on my soapbox and rant, and that's crafter.com.au. But CineTechGeek.com is where I put videos on there, and I hope to be putting up some over Christmas after I get through. I'm just very busy at the moment.
Aren't we
some
all?
We'll put a link in the show notes.
Absolutely. James, thank you so much for coming in this evening.
That's all right.
It's been wonderful. On our third last show for the year, we'll get you back in next year, and we can talk more about these wonderful topics, especially as we get to be bored to tears with Titanic 2 or the re-release in, oh my
in 3D, God, what's more?
Well, Ron's are on the ending now, so I'm not interested.
Okay. Spoilers. Odd Sport Gadget website the week after this.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show,
Tech Talk Radio.
You should have seen the odd spot that Andrew sent me. That's with tone raised.
Sorry, Adelaide. Sorry, Brisbane.
Sorry, Canberra.
Sorry, Darwin.
Oh, it'll get there in the end.
A question for Lena, gamer and mum.
Hey, that's me.
It's no good writing an agreement that's only enforceable in 1850.
Java, my friend. Java. Yeah.
Could be Java. Yeah.
Have you got a spare Google Plus invite? Yeah, it's in the mail.
Yay, my first Nerd Alert.
First Nerd Alert. Yeah.
It is.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! This thing is amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Out of my hole!
This week's... Is it quick enough?
Yeah, it'd slow down just a tad, I reckon.
The Sierra Wireless AirCard 320U. We were talking earlier about Telstra's fake 4G. It's not really 4G, it's LTE.
LTE.
This is the modem that they badge up as their next-G modem. It's a USB LTE modem for laptops, notebooks and netbooks, and it offers download speeds of up to 100 megabits per second and upload speeds of up to 50 megabits per second. In addition to LTE, it also supports dual carrier HSPA. It's got a rotating USB
hinge. High speed packet access. You're using all these acronyms. We're full of acronyms.
High speed packet access. That's the one. And it works on a number of bands. Supports all the Windows flavors of operating systems, Mac OS X and Linux Ubuntu 9.04. You can even plug an external antenna in. It's being marketed by Telstra as the USB 4G modem. That's not 4G. Its outright buy price is about $299. That's our gadget, Andrew. The Sierra Wireless AirCard 320U.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
A geek sexy.
Yes.
www.geeksaresexy.net. This is a tech, science and social news website which will appeal to all Tech Talk listeners everywhere, I think.
Oh, good.
From ray guns to mosquitoes, robot videos to designer coffee mugs. If you're a geek, or if you live with a geek, or you know a geek, then this is the website for you.
Christmas is coming.
Well, can you buy things there?
You can. It's got a section for of tech videos, how-tos. Yeah, it's got a cosplay photo library.
Ooh.
For hardcore gamers. It has got an online store, Andrew. You can buy merchandise and much, much more.
That's where you get your T-shirts from. No, you're a T3 boy or something.
Christmas is coming.
Christmas is coming.
It's a month away.
We need these sorts of stores in our arsenal. That's the website, geeksaresexy.net.
Tech Talk Radio, app of the week.
Thank you to R. DeMays for this week's suggestion. Google Translate for Android is the app of the week. With Google Translate, you can translate words and phrases between more than 60 languages.
Gee, do you need one of these for his holiday? Who was it who wanted one of these? I can't remember. As you were.
For most languages, you can speak your phrases and hear the corresponding translations. You can also translate by speaking the text instead of typing it. That's clever. Listen to your translation spoken aloud. Communicate with another person using speech-to-speech translation in conversation mode. And display translations in full screen mode to make it easier for others nearby to read. Now, Mr. or Ms. DeMay says, I started playing with this app. It seems surprisingly good at translating. I've only tested it out in Italian, which is my second language, but I'll try and work it out, do some more at work with some other languages. It's in the Android market, Andrew, and
we'll put
free.
It on the website. Fantastic.
That's our app, Google Translate for Android.
Can you dig it?
No, ma'am. We're musicians.
Ma, the meatloaf!
Bon.
You can't handle the truth!
And the hits just keep on coming.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Andrew, what lengths would you go to watch free-to-air television?
Not me.
Graham, would you plug an antenna in?
None at all. No, I wouldn't cross the room to plug an antenna in, no.
Oregon police say a man broke
Oregon.
Into... Yes.
Oregano.
Oregon.
Oregano police. No, that's something altogether different.
Oh, sorry, too many cooking shows.
Say a man broke into a family's home on Halloween Eve just to watch television.
Oh, really?
In the middle of the night.
What was he watching?
When confronted by a family friend, the man was found in the living room holding the TV remote, sitting on the couch. He said he just wanted to watch television, and then it was Halloween, and anyway, the doormat said, welcome.
Oh, gosh.
Oh.
He wasn't welcome, however. After a brief fracas, the man was detained until police arrived. He's now
being... Who detained him?
The family.
Oh, really?
He's now facing charges
of... Give him popcorn.
...criminal trespass.
A family member described the incident as unsettling. That would be spot, Andrew.
Thank you, Dr. Ron.
How much time have I got left?
30 seconds. That was Tech Talk Radio for the week. Are you going to do your
talk amongst yourselves,
February 9th announcement?
February 9th? What happens on February 9th?
Okay, we haven't got any time. You'll have to tune in next week for all that. Bye for now. No, off you go.
What's February 9th?
Oh, aren't we having drinks?
In February? I'm going to do it in December. December, right,
yeah,
you?
No, off you go. Yeah, December 9th.
Now everybody's confused.
Now we're confused.
God. Stay tuned for a venue. Yes, it's the Friday after the last Tech Talk Radio for the year, so we'll organise a venue and let you all know. Have some informal drinks somewhere in town.
December.
Sorry,
Andrew will be very thirsty.
I was thinking of coming back. I will be very thirsty. Hey, that's Tech Talk Radio for this week. Thank you to Susan McLean. Thank you to Jason Gardner. Yep. Next week on the show, we have Robert Broomhead in from the Wireless Institute of Australia to tell us all what's going on in the world of amateur radio. Might be something you want to do over Christmas. Good thing to get some experience up and do all that
or
sort of stuff.
Or play Minecraft.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, regular panellists Graham Callaghan, Mark Diggins and Lena Van Deventer. Expert opinion from Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by GC Support and Shaq West. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC in Melbourne. The crew wish to thank all the stations around Australia and around the world that broadcast the show. Tech Talk Radio is available for syndication on your local station. Contact us for the two-hour version or access the one-hour show on the Community Radio Network. Visit cbaa.org.au for further details. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03-8682-9099 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, for more information. Don't forget you can follow the panellists on Twitter, join us live each Monday night in the Tech Talk Radio chat, and solve your issues on the Tech Talk Radio forum. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.